In business, you rarely hear the expression for life. You make a purchase for a product, for a service, and there's a time frame there. Well, that's not the case with Awaken 180 weight loss. Allow me to explain. You know, a year ago, I started with Awaken 180 weight loss and had incredible success losing weight. But you can lose all the weight in the world and not keep it off. And what good is it? That's why I have support for life from Awaken 180. Yeah. I mean, I go back for check-ins and make sure everything's going smoothly, but if I ever had a problem, the counselors are there to get me back on track. Why don't you do what I did and call for a consultation? 844-346-1800. 844-346-1800 or go to awaken180weightloss.com.
The views or opinions expressed during this podcast from our guests do not necessarily reflect the views of our hosts or the school. Hello and welcome back to episode 2 of the Listen Up Levcast. I'm your host Salvatore and I'm joined with last week's guest Mr. Finn, who will be co-hosting with me today. Now today's episode is a very special one as we are joined by the former Member of Parliament for South Derbyshire, who also served in Margaret Thatcher's Department of Health, the 1990 Speaker of the Year, author of the best-selling Diaries 1987 to 1992 and Diaries Volume 2, and TV personality who you may have seen in Celebrity Mastermind, which he won twice, I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here, and Strictly Come Dancing, it's Edwina Curry. Hello, Edwina.
And hi.
When I ask the questions, I'll let you answer them, unlike Piers Morgan. It's a pleasure to have you joining us today, Edwina. I know you've had a tough lockdown. How has it been for you?
You're right. It was difficult because, in fact, I lost my husband back in November, not from COVID, but after a long battle with cancer. We were able to look after him at home and he had family here when he was really very ill. And it wasn't a good passing, but it was a blessing, I think, to have that opportunity. So it's been a very strange lockdown. And during the winter, I've certainly felt like I'm in hibernation, just kind of trying to get used to a whole host of new experiences, like being on my own, walking the dogs every day, which I do, and trying to stay fit and mentally calm and useful.
Yeah, that's the most important thing, to try and stay with it mentally, try and be positive. And obviously it's been really tough for you. So
yeah, obviously our sincerest condolences to you, Edwina, for your loss. You know, from both of us and obviously from everyone at school. But in a more sort of political point of view then, obviously the pandemic and lockdown has been something that's been part of our news now for the last almost a year. How do you sort of perceive the national and the global response to the pandemic?
It's an extraordinary event, and none of us will ever forget this. And for you, for the pupils and students, when you are old, you will probably bore your grandchildren and great-grandchildren by saying, I lived through the plague year. I lived through COVID. And it was unbelievable how we responded. I mean, I think it's a shame in some ways that we didn't have the experience with SARS that countries like South Korea and Thailand and Vietnam did, knowing that actually what you have to do is shut down very, very quickly. Had we had that experience, I think we would have responded maybe a week or 10 days earlier and we would have saved some lives. And we might also have done what Hong Kong did very well indeed, which was make sure that people in old people's homes were being properly looked after. I think they've only lost one person and we lost 20,000 dead. But that said, a great deal of the criticism is hindsight. And the trouble with hindsight is that's knowledge that you don't have at the time you need it.
Yep.
We did not realize that this wasn't flu. We did not realize that it was going to be so lethal for elderly people. Whereas on the other hand, it was not lethal for children, young people. You know, most pandemics like polio, for example, which I do remember from childhood, they attack young people first, and older people are more immune. This one has behaved in a completely unpredictable manner. It didn't help, of course, that in the autumn it mutated and became much more virulent. It would have been very nice if it had done what bubonic plague did, mutate and become less virulent. But it hasn't done that. It will eventually, but at the moment we're having to cope with something that's much more infectious even than the extraordinary thing we had earlier. That said, some things have gone extremely well. I think most people's adherence to lockdown has been brilliant, absolutely brilliant. And when people say there's no evidence that lockdown works, all you need to look at is the way that the numbers of cases drop.
Exactly.
Immediately after. Although the number of deaths obviously stays high for a while. The vaccine has been, particularly the AstraZeneca Oxford one, has been a game changer. And we should be very proud that back in March, the British government talked to Oxford University and said, right, you know, here's hundreds of millions of pounds, get on with it.
Absolutely.
And link up with AstraZeneca like right away. Don't wait. And please don't sign up with other companies in other places. Here is where we want to manufacture it. We want to be world leaders. We've been world leaders in the genomic analysis of exactly what's been going on. Other countries have been way behind us. And we have a very good testing system now and a not at all bad test and trace. It was terrible to begin with, but it's now tracking, you know, 300,000-400,000 people a week and twice that many contacts. The number of contacts is dropping because people are lying and they don't want their colleagues and friends to have to isolate. But it's not bad. It just wasn't what the Prime Minister boasted of. So if we've learned anything, it's to go big and talk small. And that's been a very tough lesson for Boris Johnson to learn.
It has.
Yeah. I think that's a very, very smart lesson. And I know, obviously, Keir Starmer was making a similar point in the PMQs yesterday where he was saying about, you know, there's been, as you sort of put it, as big statements and the action kind of falling behind that. So I think, as you say, talk small is definitely something that might be beneficial moving forward. But you mentioned, obviously, spending a lot of time at home in lockdown, but you were born and raised in Liverpool. How was that?
I'm a scouser to my fingertips. I grew up in a city that had been very badly bombed during the war. I was born after the Second World War. But it was a long time before I realised that actually Liverpool was badly traumatised in the war. And the community I grew up in, Orthodox Judaism, was also almost catatonic with grief and horror at what had happened, which, of course, we were memorialising this week with the 76th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. And I remember for years later after that, I would hear whispered conversations from adults with the saying, there's nothing good comes out of Germany. And what they meant was that people were trying to trace their relatives and all that was coming was news of death. And it was very, very bad. In that sense, I knew what it was like to grow up in a world where PTSD was a problem. And it was a long, long time before Liverpool recovered, at least four decades. And I and most of my generation of sixth formers had long since left. We had given up on the city. We had gone elsewhere. We had left and we knew we were never, ever going back. There were no jobs for people like us. There was no respect for people like us. Everything was deadened and pushed down. And Derek Hatton was an exact contemporary of mine at the Liverpool Institute. And what did he do? He closed it. Ah. He's currently facing corruption charges.
That's, a very, very interesting response there, I think. Your upbringing in Orthodox Judaism is something that I think Salvatore maybe wants to come back to a little bit later on.
Yeah.
But I think, you know, obviously yesterday being Holocaust Memorial Day, the 76th anniversary of the liberation of Auschwitz. I think it's a massively important date in the calendar, and one that I think we should all endeavour, you know, never to forget. But
if you, if you go to Auschwitz, if you take a school trip to Auschwitz, and when you can, you should. We never forget that actually a lot of other people died there. Yeah. The first people that fascism dealt with were its own opponents. And then it dealt with its own opponents within the Nazi party. And the resistance in countries like Poland, resistance came from all sorts. It came from the church. It came from partisans. It came from people who were patriots. And they also, they got rid of anyone who wasn't a perfect Aryan. Many years ago, before I went into Parliament, I was a Birmingham City Councillor.
Yeah.
And 1977 was the International Year of Disabled People. So we took a party of disabled people, people with disabilities, over to Frankfurt, which was our twin city in what was then West Germany. And we showed them round and talked about it. And they had a wonderful time. And I got talking to my opposite number there, the chair of the social services and welfare set up there. And I said, well, how do you cope when people with disabilities become older and they need to go into residential care? You can't just put them into an ordinary old people's home because they may need... And he got very sort of po-faced about it. And I said, what's the problem? And he said, we don't have this problem in Germany. And I said, why not? And he said, because Hitler shot them all. Mm-hmm. And that's a different kind of trauma that people have to live with afterwards. Yeah. I know this is very dark stuff, but
yeah,
there will be a long tail of issues that come out of COVID. We don't know what they are. But the experience of anyone that's lived through trauma is that you have to face it, you have to deal with it. You have to analyze and really dig down as to what it was that let things go wrong, which is why they're so keen on democracy in a country like Germany. And then you learn to live with it.
I consider myself very fortunate that I've been able to visit Auschwitz once before in 2013. And visited Bergen-Belsen in Germany earlier in 2020 before the lockdown. And I think those experiences are things that definitely stick with you, and the wider impact of that is something that's, as you say, it's not something that's going to sort of fade quickly. It does have a longer tail. But yeah, definitely an experience that I don't think anyone would forget very soon.
Yeah, I was meant to go last year, but COVID cancelled it as well. But I've got the opportunity to work with the Holocaust Educational Trust this year online. But I'd recommend anybody listening to try and get involved. And it's good to spread the awareness so nothing like that ever happens again. We are aware.
The Holocaust Educational Trust actually runs ambassadors programs.
Yeah.
So for anyone that is interested, you can go online onto their website and you can apply to become an ambassador. So you can have online training. And then hopefully when COVID is sort of behind us, you can go and visit some of the sites of the Holocaust and become a witness to that atrocity. But in terms of beyond Liverpool then and beyond your upbringing, Edwina, you managed to get a scholarship to Oxford University for chemistry, but then later decided to switch courses and read philosophy, politics, and economics. What sort of led to that change that's so drastic from science into sort of the arts and economics?
Well, I was a hopeless chemist, certainly at university level. In those days, far smaller proportion of people went on to university, and amongst that far smaller proportion were only a tiny proportion of young women. And if you wanted to get in, you had to think, where are the vacancies and where is the prejudice lowest? And science was the answer. So it's no accident that 21 years before I went to Oxford to read chemistry, that's exactly what Margaret Thatcher did.
Yes.
And her reasoning was exactly the same. That if we had tried to get to Oxford to read PPE, we wouldn't have got anywhere. The universities now really try very hard to recruit from ordinary backgrounds like both Margaret and I had. They're very conscious of unconscious bias, but they were very conscious that they were deliberately discriminating against us back in the day. Right, so you get to Oxford, you've got yourself a scholarship, and you realise that your chemistry ain't ever going to be any good. Plus, they've just given a Nobel Prize to a woman chemist called Dorothy Hodgkin, and so the bar has been lifted, way up there. Right, what do? You go and talk to the principal, and you say, I don't think I'm good enough to be doing this. And she says, so what do you do in your spare time? And I say, oh, I go to politics lecturers. My boyfriend is on Oxford City Council. And we go to the Nuffield. She said, that's postgraduate college. I said, well, it's interesting. They're doing all the stuff about how opinion polls are created. And I've got maths A level, so I probably understand it better than quite a lot of other people there. Yeah, she said, well, you've only been here a term. You're going to postgrad courses. Well, you could switch to PPE if you want. I said, well, just like that. And she said, well, yes, you are accepted at this university by the whole university, not by a faculty.
Amazing.
And thank God for being Liverpool, because you immediately switch and can I keep my scholarship? I can't manage without that. Oh, I'm sure we'll arrange that. And there we go. That's what happened. And the thing about PPE was I had no general reading whatsoever. If you do science, you're used to doing every bit of every sentence, learning it, and then regurgitating it. I had scholarship level and distinctions and all that stuff. I found that easy. My first essay was on Disraeli, and I had a book 800 pages long to read in a week. The politics tutor was a Marxist. She was later discovered to have been part of a spy ring. What on earth should we find that you could sell to the Russians? God knows. But she was a witch with a capital B. She really was. So I then had to go and have a moan about this to my nice Tory councillor boyfriend. And he said, oh, that's not a problem. I'll teach you. You teach me? He said, yes. He said, I'm a junior research fellow. And you just go and tell the principal you don't want Mrs. Hart to do it. You want me to do it. And I'll get paid for seeing you. How about that? So that's what we did. And I ended up eating at Merton High Table, which, you know, for a kid from Liverpool, was really quite something. I recommend it. I remember one of the dons leaning over my glass with a large decanter, a port that was about three times as old as I was, and saying, now you're supposed to drink this to the very last drop, my dear.
Did you?
I don't remember, so probably yes.
And then after Oxford, you took your master's degree in economic history at the London School of Economics. And I read that that experience turned you into a lifelong conservative. Why was that?
Well, just bear in mind, it was pretty unusual to do a master's degree in those days. It's much more common now. Yeah. I went from Oxford to train as an accountant because I found I liked money and finance and economics. And I married my boss, which rather broke the rules about no fraternisation. I mean, the fact his brother was there, that didn't count, even though you and I know that frater is the Latin for brother.
Yeah.
But no fraternisation meant one of us had to go. And so I was happy to do that. I went to work in the civil service for a while. And I was a statistician in the Ministry of Technology under Tony Wedgwood Benn. How about that? Taught me that I was bored to tears being a civil servant. It really didn't do. So I looked at what to do next. LSE were about to introduce a new one-year master's in economic history, which is great because then you know what the answers are. The thing about economic history is you may be looking at what happened in the 18th century or the 19th century, but you know what happened afterwards. So you're not just guessing as modern economists would be. And so that's what I did that for a year. It was a time of there was a bit of a leftover, a second, third wave of student demos. We'd had them in 1968 with the sit-ins and problems in Paris. And by in 71 and 72, we got some more of this at the LSE in London. And they were all lefties. And what struck me was not only were they all lefties, but they all came from wealthy families. So it didn't matter if they messed up their degree. Yeah. And it sure as heck mattered if I did.
Hmm.
And I found myself really very resentful of their assumption that we were all socialists and Marxists in the kind of environment that I grew up in. Striving was the only way you were going to make a success. It certainly wasn't going to come at the hands of any government. We knew what governments could do and the evil that they could do. And by then I was very actively involved in the Tory party. I had been since I was about 16, 17, partly because if you want to get into Oxford or Cambridge, you need to have a broad general background. You know, when you're asked, what did you do at half term? It's no good if you say skiing.
Mm.
You know? And so I needed a broader background. I found it fascinating. And politics as well opens opportunities for all sorts of people.
It does, yeah.
And that's why I was always interested in Margaret Thatcher.
Mm.
She was, even when there were only 10 women in the House of Commons, and she was a young married woman scientist with small children. And she was making a success of it. She was a junior minister in pensions, which needs brains and ferocious concentration. And she was doing okay. And so I was beginning to think, well, if she can do it, maybe I can do it. It's obviously possible. It can be done. And by 1975, I was on Birmingham City Council.
Yep.
My husband and I had taken a long, hard look at it and thought, do you know what? We stay in London. There's only 70 constituencies in London at that time. And there are hundreds, thousands of very well-qualified people who want those seats. Whereas if we head into the provinces, we are better qualified than most, and there are fewer people that want to go there. Whereas perhaps that's a good place to go. So we went to Birmingham. He opened up a new office for Arthur Anderson there. And I was on Birmingham City Council, just like that. In a trice, with a baby tucked under one arm. then in a trice, I was chairing social services, and I was chairing the health authority, and I was chairing housing, usually because I could add up.
And why did you decide to run for parliament? Was it always an ambition of yours? Or
I think the real thinking about that came at uni, at Oxford, observing a lot of people who were pretty sure that they were going to become MPs.
Yeah.
Why? Because Daddy was an MP. They had names like Hailsham or Waldegrave, or their fathers had been in Harold Macmillan's cabinet.
Mm-hmm.
There were loads of them, dozens and dozens of them. And at that point, you start asking yourself, well, if they can do it, what's stopping me? And what's stopping you is prejudice. So that means, as Margaret used to say, it just means that women have got to be better at it than the men. They have to stand out, they have to be more persistent. So when I knew I could start applying for seats, I thought, right, I'm going to give myself 50 goes. If I can't get into 50 different interviews, I may think of something else to do. And I got the number 21. And what I think happens is that most women who start this, in fact, most people who start this process, they give up after about number 4 or number 5. So my lesson from that is don't give up, keep going. If you keep going, you will get there. You will sooner or later. Oh, and the other thing I would recommend is always get feedback.
Yep.
So after I came maybe number 2 or number 3, I would phone up the professional agent or whoever organised the selection committee or selection event and say, well, congratulations, you've got yourself a candidate now. Could you give me any guidance as to why I didn't get it? Mm. And I got the most peculiar responses, the exact sort of things you wouldn't expect. I remember one lady saying to me, one agent saying to me, oh, you were fine. It was your husband. It was chartered accountant. Well, it was just that when you were making your speech, he was looking at the ceiling and he was looking at his nails and he was doing everything except look at you. It really doesn't matter how many times he's heard you say it. Tell him he's got to stare at your left ear hole and just keep staring at it while you're speaking. So when Ray came home, I told him, and he went off to the pub without a word. But the next one, he stared at my left ear hole. There's actually a picture of him staring at my left ear hole. Another example was an agent, a man who said, oh, you were fine. You were by far the best, but you were too pretty.
Oh.
What? And he said, look, you were wearing a very pretty, you know, flowers and all that kind of thing. He says, you want to be an MP, you've got to look like an MP. Wear a black suit. I don't have a black suit. He said, well, go and buy one. So I did. I bought a very smart black velvet suit with filigree on it. Looked a little bit Spanish. And I got the next one. He was dead right.
Wow. Wow. That is amazing. Yes. So you did spend 14 years in Parliament and you was in the health department for 2 years under Margaret Thatcher. What was it you did? So you looked up to Margaret Thatcher before. What was it like serving in her health department?
It was the Department of Health and Social Security then. And I must say, I would rather far rather be on the health side than on the Social Security side.
Mm.
Because you can make progress with health. It was quite scary being one of her ministers. In those years, particularly from the Falklands till about 1989, so that's a period of about 7 years, she was absolutely at the top of her game, both bringing in, sucking in information. She had an extraordinary head for detail. And using it and very quickly working out what needed to be done. And then with enormous determination, actually sticking with that. I had a mining constituency and they didn't go on strike. And she was phenomenal in standing up to the kind of destructive communist trade unionism that had been wrecking the country up to that point for many decades. And I don't think anybody else would have had the guts and the determination, the persistence again, to stick with it in the way that she did. It was enormously helpful that she was not a compromiser when it came to something she believed in. Mm. And you could always convince her to make improvements. She was a real radical. She was not a conservative with a small c when it came to things that she could be convinced about. So we brought in breast cancer screening. We brought in cervical cancer screening. We brought in big improvements in the kind of food that people could eat. I got to know the supermarkets very well. You couldn't buy skim milk in a bottle then. You can now. A whole range of Mediterranean foods and so on. Improvements in diet. Realization that smoking is so dangerous. All of that, if you look at the figures in the 80s, we were really starting to make big progress.
Yeah.
We had the first campaign against HIV/AIDS. We mm-hmm. had the first international conference on HIV/AIDS in Britain, in London, called Margaret Thatcher's government. She did say to us, well, I don't want to have anything to do with it. Fine, Margaret. We don't need any preaching. Yeah. And in that sense, it was exciting. She was also very good to her junior ministers. And that's because she was highly suspicious of the cabinet, who she thought were all her rivals and trying to do her down. And about some of them, she was right.
Yes, she was.
So junior minister would come to her with a proposition. You more like to get it. It was very exciting, very exciting. It started to go wrong, I thought, by 1989, I think she started to believe all her own propaganda about how brilliant she was.
Mm.
And that's when I think the rot set in, and it wasn't long 18 months after that, she was gone.
Wow. And that's how quickly it can change in politics. Yeah. So you were a member of parliament under John Major's party.
Yeah. I stayed in parliament. I held on to my seat in 87. Yes. I held on again in 92, and we were returned with a very small majority, which turned out to disappear over the next 4 or 5 years. That was a very difficult parliament to be in. If you read my diaries for that tranche of time, from 92 to 97, I apologise here now for being so miserable and rotten and rude about everybody. I was a very angry lady.
No, that's okay.
When he won the election of 92, he did offer me a job and I turned it down. It was a horrible job.
That's what I was going to say. Why did you turn it down?
Minister of Prisons. I was going to be number two in the Home Office. You know, tell me a successful, popular Home Secretary, and I'll tell you, you're going back to Sir Robert Peel, probably.
Do you not think you could have furthered your career from that?
Not a chance. I had two prisons in the constituency, and the system had changed so that the minister wasn't running the prisons. It was being done by a prisons agency, hands-on. And the chap that had been appointed to be in charge of that was quite an arrogant character. Oh, I could just see myself getting to big rows. And the next big prison riot that happened, or prison officer got killed or whatever, would be down to me, even though there was nothing whatever I could have done about it. Plus by then I was starting to write novels. I'd published a couple of non-fiction books. I was starting to write a novel in September, actually on Black Wednesday in September of 92. We auctioned it, and in fact my lovely agent phoned me up and said, "Are you sitting down?" And I said, "Why?" He said, "Well, good things are happening." I said, "No, they're not. The economy's falling apart. It's Black Wednesday, you know, we're coming out of the ERM and so on." And he said, "No, you've just got a contract that's six figures, you know."
Wow.
So I knew that was in the offing. The weird thing about that was I then had to go to the BBC Derby studio that evening with Margaret Beckett, who was the Labour spokesman, who was my immediate neighbour. And I couldn't get a grin off my face. She said, "You were supposed to be miserable. Just sold a book." Yes.
In business, you rarely hear the expression "for life." You make a purchase for a product, for a service, and there's a time frame there. Well, that's not the case with Awaken 180 weight loss. Allow me to explain. You know, a year ago, I started with Awaken 180 weight loss and had incredible success losing weight. But you can lose all the weight in the world and not keep it off. And what good is it? That's why I have support for life from Awaken 180. Yeah. I mean, I go back for check-ins and make sure everything's going smoothly. But if I ever had a problem, the counselors are there to get me back on track. Why don't you do what I did and call for a consultation? 844-346-1800. 844-346-1800. Or go to awaken180weightloss.com.
Now, as well as your charity work for the likes of Marie Curie Cancer Care and the British Heart Foundation, you're also a champion for homosexual equality in the 1990s. You're a member of the Tory campaign for homosexuality. Could you talk a bit about that and what challenges you faced from members inside the party and the community?
It was called the Tory Campaign for Homosexual Equality, Torch. Yeah. And the symbol of the party at that time was a torch.
Mm-hmm.
So that's where that came from. It grew out of AIDS. It grew out of Clause 28 in the 1980s, and the feeling that when the Prime Minister talked about every child has an unalienable right to two parents, a mother and a father, that she was simply wrong. And that indeed, deep in the back of my mind was, if people are to stay healthy, we need to encourage them perhaps not to be promiscuous, to settle into good relationships. And that can only happen if the stigma against being homosexual disappears and is no longer there. And you start with the law. You have to start with the law. And we had many discussions about this. I was always interested. I grew up in Liverpool, where you can't be prejudiced in a seaport. We used to say you never knew who your grandma met up a dark alley on a Saturday night. And it's a much more open location than perhaps, you know, parts of where you live. But it meant that I was relaxed about it. And it became apparent after a while that the fact that I was a married woman with two daughters meant that I could be a very useful, could play a useful part in the leadership of this. I said, if we're going to carry forward changing the status of homosexuals, it has to be the age of consent. And they said, you're going to talk about sex in the House of Commons? Yes, let me at it. That would be wonderful. I said, but it has to be all party. And they said, so who do you want as your seconder? And I said, Neil Kinnock, recently retired as leader of the Labour. And they said, he won't do it. I said, why won't he do it? Well, because he's from South Wales and he's got two sons. And I said, that's exactly why he should do it. He believes in equality. And if he can stand up in Parliament and talk through over that hump, over that problem, that's very powerful. So Neil and I met and had rock buns in secret in St. Dermot's Hotel. And I had a go at him. And he went, all right. And he was wonderful. He was absolutely wonderful from there onwards. And I think what changed that night, although we didn't get equality, we got the age of consent down from 21 to 18. We won the argument.
Yeah.
Big time. It was the first time it had been debated in the House of Commons, 25 years. I couldn't get into my office the next day. The whole corridor was full of flowers. We had to start sending them to Great Ormond Street Hospital or somewhere else. I made lots of friends. I entered a world I knew it existed, but I hadn't been part of. And I'm glad I did that. The way I would argue it is, if you have known prejudice and discrimination, you should do what you can to remove it, even if it doesn't affect you. It affects everybody. And if you have known discrimination, you shouldn't practice it, which is why I'm against all women shortlists. I think the best way to tackle any kind of discrimination is to talk it through. The best way to tackle any kind of misunderstanding is not to ban it, but to talk about it and debate it. And that way, I think we make real progress.
Yeah, I think that's a really fantastic point. I think when we look at discrimination as a topic, it sort of derives itself from ignorance in a way. And so it's that idea of education and discussion and making things, you know, no longer taboo to discuss and actually have an open conversation about. That's, as you say, that a way that we're going to sort of successfully navigate to equality. Salvatore was mentioning challenges then with that, but one other challenge that you faced was by 97 losing your seat to Mark Todd in the election. How did you sort of respond to that and feel around that experience?
I was expecting it. One of the things that happens if you are keeping your eyes and your ears open, you're trying to make notes that are relevant. I thought at that stage, I wasn't planning to publish the diaries, but I thought I could at some future point perhaps write a personal memoir of the Thatcher years of that extraordinary administration. And therefore, I knew that the major government was extremely weak. The opportunity was the opportunity to deal with Euroscepticism was never properly taken. That was growing, we see now, because of the changing pattern of thinking on the continent as well, and the centralizing propositions that became part of the Maastricht Treaty, and then subsequently the Lisbon Treaty. But nobody was making the argument vigorously for Europe in the UK. And we actually caught John Major out more than once. So, for example, I was part of something called the Positive European Group of backbenchers, and we would try and support him as he was getting the Maastricht legislation through Parliament. And he would say to us in briefings, I'm so glad you've got this group, it's really helpful. And then I'd find myself chatting to someone like Teddy Taylor, who was in the European Reform Group, which was Eurosceptic. And he'd say, we've just had a meeting with the Prime Minister. And he said to us, he's the biggest Eurosceptic in the cabinet. And I'd look at Teddy and he'd look at me and we'd compare notes. And bless him, the Prime Minister bore on his face the impression of whoever had sat on him last, which is not great. And that means the moment somebody more charismatic comes along in the form of Tony Blair,
yeah,
we're sunk big time, sunk big time. Plus, he did the Lib Lab Pact, which helped to destroy the Liberal Democrats. And that was clever politics. So I don't think anyone was expecting that he would get such a huge majority, but he did. And I knew my seat was very, very vulnerable. The moment one person is going to fight it, I'm going to lose. But by then, I'm writing books, I'm working for the BBC, all of which means more freedom and more money.
Yes. Not bad. And that moves nicely on as we're going to talk about your time on TV. And one of the last shows that you were in on TV was BBC Two's The Pilgrimage, which I really enjoyed. It was absolutely fascinating. Could you tell the listeners how that experience was and how you learned more about the Jewish faith?
It was the third series of Pilgrimage. And they had done the Santiago one, and they had done a pilgrimage in Italy, ending in Rome, with an audience with the Pope.
The Pope, yeah.
Yeah, I remember watching that one.
I'd like to get involved. I was just a bit sad we weren't going to Rome again. We did the Sultan's Trail, and that involved flying to Sofia It involved flying to Belgrade, that's right, and walking to Sofia, going from Serbia through to Bulgaria, and then into the Bulgarian forests on the edge of the border with Greece. Absolutely stunning area. And then through to Istanbul. The idea being that we were following the Sultan's Trail, which was taken by Sultan Suleiman the Magnificent, contemporary of Henry VIII, who three times invaded Europe and got to the gates of Vienna and lost three times. And so we were going down the route backwards. And it was wonderful. And I was asked my particular interest, what did I want to find? I said, you know, there used to be big Jewish communities, these old trading routes. There used to be big Jewish communities along these routes. And I would like to see, there are very few Jews living there now. The history of the countries are very different. Serbia was really Nazi. Bulgaria, which of course has an outlet onto the Black Sea and again is much more of a trading country, they looked after their Jews. They started off before the war with about 48,000 Jews. They ended the war with about 44,000. What they did was they spirited them away into the countryside. They turned them into labourers and they looked after them. And many of them stayed on after the war as partisans and supporters of Tito. So I actually got to meet some of them, locals who were Jewish, which didn't happen in Serbia. In Serbia, the visit was to a concentration camp, still in the middle of a big town called Niš. Absolutely unbelievable. It's a museum now, but it should have been pulled down 70 years ago, garden planted. And it was set up, it was kept because the Soviets wanted to prove that all fascism was done by the Germans. All right. And it wasn't. It was done by the locals. It was very moving, uplifting in Bulgaria, uplifting in the eastern part of Turkey, where American money has restored some of the synagogues, which are quite stunning, absolutely beautiful, and where communities are worshipping in them on an occasional basis. But they're tourist sites, and the opportunity is taken to talk about Judaism and how people came through that area, how they left and came through and got to Israel and were part of setting up the new state of Israel. Fascinating stuff. I'm very, very glad I had the opportunity to do that. Oh, and one other thing. We were actually recording at the time of the Jewish New Year in September.
Oh, amazing.
So I got hold of an apple and a honeycomb. Honeycomb was as big as this, absolutely fabulous Bulgarian honey. Oh, God, it was fabulous. And we effectively toasted in the new year that you have an apple for fruitfulness, you should have a fruitful year, and a honey for sweetness, you should have a sweet year. And I got that actually into the program.
Yeah, that was an amazing scene. That must have been really special for you.
Sounds like a really, really fantastic experience. Would you say that it was your favorite experience on TV, or do you think that you've enjoyed your time on some other shows a little bit more?
I love winning Celebrity Mastermind twice.
I thought that.
Doing this again. I'm getting too old. The brain's going. Oh, and the other thing was I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here.
Mm.
If you ever, ever get a chance to do the Cyclone, do it.
You was lucky enough to do that. Yeah.
I thoroughly enjoyed that. It was much warmer in Australia than it would have been in a Welsh castle.
Yeah. Like anytime I watch the Cyclone, that's the thing I'm most jealous of. Like it's my biggest reason for wanting to be a celebrity, you know. Nothing else other than the Cyclone.
I'm surprised nobody has actually set it up in a theme park here, because it really is something else. On the other hand, maybe throwing four-year-old kids into something like that is not very safe.
I'd love to see the risk assessment.
Me too.
And what group did you get on with the most? The group in The Pilgrimage, the group in Hell's Kitchen, or maybe the group in I'm a Celebrity? There was some moments where you clashed.
Well, it depends. Yes, it depends a bit. I won't suffer fools gladly, I'm afraid. Yes. Goes straight back to my upbringing. And that means that on both those shows, both The Pilgrimage and I'm a Celebrity, I became very close and friendly with some people and very wary of other people. Now, when it comes to something like I'm a Celebrity, not this year, the whole tone, I think, was very different. Mm. They needed it to be uplifting and positive because of COVID. But most years, if everyone gets on well, it's boring.
Yes.
It's conflict that actually sets everyone afire and brings in 11 million people watching and lots of votes and all the rest of it. And that meant that I knew there'd be conflict. And the thing is to be on the right side of that conflict. So they had this crazy American woman who'd been in the Playboy house.
Yeah, Hugh Hefner, wasn't it?
Yeah. Very tacky. And thought that she knew something about real life and would be pontificating. And at one stage I heard her say, she's very, very beautiful, but thick. at one stage I heard her saying, you should never live your life for other people.
Yeah.
I said, say that again, come again. You should never live your life for other people. And I think what she meant to say was, you shouldn't let other people tell you what to do,
mm-hmm.
with which I might in part have agreed. But I immediately said, well, I don't agree. I know lots of people live their lives for other people. Nurses do. My husband was a police officer for 35 years. He would have given his life for other people. You know, he was an armed officer at one stage. This was serious stuff, I felt. And what I hadn't realized was that someone else had had the same argument with her earlier in the program, which in fact they didn't show. Tinchy Strider, who's Christian, had also challenged her on some of her views. And she swore at him, and being a nice lad, he backed off. All right?
Oh, yeah.
So she started swearing at me, and I don't back off.
Yes.
I said, well, I've been yelled at by the likes of Margaret Thatcher. You're not going to intimidate me. And it went viral big time.
It did, yeah.
And some of the others wanted me to sort of, you know, calm down. But I was thinking, thank you, God.
Mm.
I knew I was on the right side of that. Other than that, you know, there are lovely people on it. Vicky Michelle, who did Allo Allo, the brilliant mimic, a beautiful, talented actress. She kept us entertained by doing all the Allo Allo shows and a few others and Carry On and stuff with all the accents. That was good.
And was you, well, the British public loved you. You came fourth, you managed to do the Cyclone. How did you feel coming out, the reception for you?
Well, I was knackered. It was exhausting. And it took me several days to come down. I had hoped that I was going to come out early. And then I got a visit organised to what we call Ayers Rock. Somebody on the crew was married into the family, the clan that owned that area. And she would have arranged to go and see her family there and take me with as an honoured guest. And that would have been amazing because it's not that open to the public anymore.
Yeah.
And so there was a sense of disappointment coming out just the day before it all finished and then going home 2 days later. There wasn't time. And my family were out there by then as well. So I wouldn't have been able to leave them. Came home and found myself famous all over again.
Yeah, we have a question from one of our students, Ed, who's in year 13. And that it goes on to that. He asks, what sort of career opportunities did you get after you came out of the jungle?
Well, I suppose the most important one that happened was doing Panto the following year.
Yeah.
That I had been asked to do Panto some years before, but I thought to myself, do you know what? This one I should try because it was not far from home. I didn't have to stay in a hotel. I could just drive 40 minutes from home and go and do all the rehearsal, because there's as many weeks of rehearsal as there are of performance. People don't always realise that, and you're not paid for rehearsal. And so I came home and said to my husband, I'm going to do Panto this year. And he said, oh, lovely. Which one? Snow White. He said, are you Snow White? I said, no. I'm the Wicked Queen. I'm going to do it in a Margaret Thatcher voice. Dressed like Cruella de Vil or Maleficent. In fact, I got a fancy dress that looked like Maleficent, you know.
Yeah.
Stuff. And it went off. And so he said, oh, I see. So who's the star? I said, I am.
God. Oh, no, go on, sorry.
I was going to say, that was the opportunity I took. I could have done all sorts of other stuff. But by then, John was not that well. And it struck me that the best thing to do was actually spend as much time as we could together while we could travel and enjoy ourselves. And that's what we did.
And was that created happy memories for you and him?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I'll give you an example. One of his sons is in Bermuda and is a very, very successful international artist. Does beautiful paintings. I got them in the other room. And he did so well that he was able to buy David Bowie's house in Bermuda.
Wow.
Which is quite something. You know, walk straight out on the beach. And I said to John, we're going. We are going to see this. And I'm very glad that we did.
I think that sounds like a very, very good use of your time.
Exactly, yeah. As I mentioned at the start, you've written a lot of novels, but the two that stick out are your diaries. Were you surprised at how well they were received?
I've done six novels, three of which were set in Parliament, with some perhaps slightly recognisable characters in them. In fact, the funny thing was that the people, my colleagues who thought they were in, weren't.
Weren't.
And the ones who were in didn't realise. And we never got sued, which was good. Right? You have to be careful sometimes. There was one character, a woman character, who was actually based on a very well-known woman journalist at the time, editor of one or two things, not Rachel Johnson. And I made her a bit of a sex fiend, and very good in bed. And we did get a message from a slip, which of course the truthful answer was yes. But I did say to my publisher, look, she is not going to sue. She is not going to stand up. I know her. She is not going to stand up in court and say, I'm not as good in bed as Edwina says I am. That's not going to happen. And I was right. The diaries were always around. And after I got married, I stopped writing novels because you need an awful lot of time to do it. And I decided not to make the same mistakes as I had in my first marriage, but to give a lot more time to this one. So my publisher said, what have you got? And I said, well, I could write a memoir about Margaret Thatcher. I kept some diaries. Oh, he said, let's have a look. And then he came back with a grin on his face and he said, we can publish these just as they are. And do you want to tell me who B is in the diaries? And I said, well, A was my husband. He said, right, who's B? And the outcome of that was that we decided in the end that it would be dishonest to hide it. And also, there was a correction factor because John Major, as Prime Minister and ex-Prime Minister, had published a memoir of his time in office. And it was a load of rubbish, a lot of it. There's a complete whitewash. He had no idea why he'd left office and why we had done so badly. And some of that was the whole thing about Tory sleaze. And I thought it was about time somebody realised that he should have given some thought to that. So that was in the diaries. And boy, did that hit the fan.
Yeah.
Never mind.
Do you regret putting that in or not?
No, because in the end, a lot of what I've done is economics and history. And in the end, if we are going to understand a period of time, we need to have accurate documentation. We need to have accurate reports of the time. If we have a whitewash or some partial view, then we don't understand what's happened. I'll give you a different example. Churchill sat down immediately after World War II and wrote his history of it. And that became the story. And it's much later that you get historians like Max Hastings going back to the original sources and finding that at least some of it wasn't nearly the way that Churchill painted it. That's a pity when you get a revision like that. Churchill was not rude about the Americans, for example, and perhaps he should have been. That kind of thing. So, no, the diaries were kept at the time. I didn't realise that some of the entries were going to become so much more significant later, but they're out there now and they're available for anybody to read and make their own judgment.
How did you sort of feel in terms of releasing that to the public? I think from my perspective, I think I'd find it really difficult to allow private information to enter the sort of public realm. How did you build yourself up to do that?
Oh, gosh. Now, it's already nearly 20 years ago since that happened. So my memory of it is not too accurate. I was pleased in a way that my story was going out. And I've had comments since from very substantial writers and historians that actually what the diaries as published demonstrated was what it was like being a woman in the House of Commons in the 80s and the most of the 90s at a time when there were only a few women and certainly only a few conservative women. And what a very strange and peculiar world it really was. So that feels like a vindication. And I have decided that all the papers to do with that time, I will eventually leave to the Women's Library, which is part of London University, Goldsmiths College. And then who knows, you know, hundreds of years from now, they might actually turn out to be a useful history source. I hope so. It's very nice when you write your own story and some people actually take it on board and realise that you were telling the truth.
And
historical value.
Exactly. And you mentioned the Americans with Churchill and America now. We have a new president with Biden. How do you feel, as somebody who is involved in politics, how do you feel the special relationship with the UK and US will be?
Well, I watched TV. I watched the election night. And I watched CNN for three solid weeks afterwards. Oh, my God. I'm heartily glad to see the back of Trump. I think he was a menace to democracy and a menace in many ways to the peace of the world and to the reputation of the free world. Very, very glad to see him gone. It actually came home to everybody in America on January the 6th.
Yes.
With that invasion of Congress and those the threats to the life even of his own vice president, Mike Pence, who did absolutely the honourable and noble thing by coming to the inauguration of Joe Biden. Now, Biden doesn't have time on his side, but he does have experience. And it'd be very interesting to see how his presidency works out. We have a special relationship in that we appear to talk the same language.
Yeah, basically, yeah.
I think it was Roosevelt or Churchill possibly who said that we are divided by the same language. America and Britain are divided by the same language. But remember, Churchill's mother was an American, so he perhaps felt closer to it than we do. I don't like the idea of us following America into war.
No.
We should be cautious. We didn't with the Vietnam War. We should help when we can. We should always do it through part of a much bigger alliance like NATO. It would be good to see NATO revived. I would like to see many of the United Nations organizations cleansed. I think Trump had a point about them being corrupt, but the way you deal with them is not to leave, but to get more engaged. UNESCO and the Food and Development Programme. A lot of these are very, very good organisations. UNICEF became, I think, it acquired a dreadful reputation in Haiti for the way it was exploiting people. There are improvements to be made. And the same is true for the World Trade Organisation, the World Health Organisation, and so on. So we have opportunities to do great stuff there. The UK has opportunities because we're now a free country, and I think we should seize that with both hands. And America has because it's had a nasty brush with nutters and I think has realised that it can't be like that. So the next few years will be very interesting. The quicker we can get COVID sorted and vaccinated and everybody up and running, get our economies running again, the better.
Exactly, yeah. And where do you think that the UK will prosper the most now that we've come out of the EU?
Some unexpected gains will be vaccines.
Yeah.
Biochemical research, absolutely phenomenal. I'm so proud of Oxford. Oh, God, it's hellions. so proud. I joined in a number of seminars available to Oxford alumni. The reputation of the university already high has absolutely soared. That will benefit our university sector generally, which brings in normal years, brings in billions and billions of pounds. And that's to be welcomed. Looking forward to seeing universities and schools and colleges returning to normal at a higher level. Our education system, I think, has really proven itself in this pandemic. We will see permanent changes. The high street will never be the same again. The City of London, and you're not going to have millions commuting again. I think we might see the centre of the city turning into something more like Greenwich Village. Now, wouldn't that be wonderful, with much smaller tenancies and a much livelier, a more diverse pattern of employment? We've realised how important startups are. There's a lot of venture capital out there looking for startups, nurturing them from somebody's great idea to the point where they're actually commercially successful, and then on to late stage before they actually come to the stock market and float off on their own. The economy, the green economy, really important. Outside here, there's an electric car plugged in. On the roof, solar panels.
I've had
1983. Margaret Thatcher made a great speech in 1989 to the United Nations about the importance of climate change. We need to be leaders in this and not followers. We need to have battery factories in this country. Nissan and Toyota and other manufacturers have said they will manufacture electric cars in Britain, and we should be world leaders. We've got to get out there and sell. We've got to get out there and make. And the quicker we can get back to a different normal, the better.
Mm-hmm. And the Prime Minister wants a green Britain. We're hosting the Climate Change Summit in Glasgow as well, which would be good to work with America and other nations as well. What do you think about his vision for a green Britain?
I think Carrie Symons is one of the best things that's ever happened to him. Great. We're going to vaccinate cattle. Brilliant. Instead of killing badgers. How lovely it is to actually enter, you know, the 19th century with vaccinations. Goodness me. We have to benefit from this. This is going to happen, and it has to happen. And having been one of the earliest countries into the Industrial Revolution 200 years ago, we need to be one of the first countries into the next industrial revolution of green energy. This is happening. It's happening in the northeast of England, where hydrogen generation development is going apace. It's happening on the North Cheshire area around the Dee estuary, where Peel, who own the Manchester Ship Canal and Liverpool Docks and Harbour Board and so on, they are developing hydrogen energy as well, and have been granting all sorts of licenses. There's a lot going on around here, around where I live. It's old ICI territory, and the opportunities are being used in an area that doesn't mind manufacturing and chemicals and so on, to replace petrol refining by doing different kind of fuel generation. Very exciting stuff. It's all in its infancy, but it's going hell for leather. And I look forward to it. And it will help with the levelling up that we have to do in the north of England. If Boris wants to go on being Prime Minister after 2024, we really got to see hope for the future here. And I think that's the way to do it.
Yes. And it's going to be a test for him coming out of COVID. But how do you think the local elections will go this year?
It's hard to tell. It's a good question. It's hard to tell. Let's assume we have them on May the 6th.
Yes.
They've been postponed from last year already. At the moment, Tories and Labour are neck and neck, which is not quite what you expect when 100,000 people are dead. And that's certainly not what happened in America. I think a lot of ordinary voters cut Boris a lot of slack. They recognize how hard it is for ministers to take decisions against a fog of not knowing, of having out of date or inadequate information, incomplete data that's going to be revised in months' time and show that you were wrong or that you should have done something differently. They're cutting him a lot of slack. It will depend what happens, I think, a bit between now and May. I'm going to be involved. I'm the president of the local Conservative Association, and we at the moment control Derbyshire County Council. I hope that will continue to be the case. The usual question I get asked at the end of anything with students is, what advice would I give to somebody who
that's
might
one
be
that you mentioned earlier, Salvatore?
I was going to say that. I didn't want to be too cliche, but I might as well ask it anyway. So what advice would you give to somebody who wants to get into politics?
The first is, get the best education you can. It will always stand you in good stead. The second is that if you are interested, please, please, I pray, don't go straight from a degree in politics or history to working for an MP to going into a safe seat. Because you know what? You will hit the ground running and you could be famous by the time you're 30. But the moment things go wrong, you have no experience, no hinterland. Mm-hmm. So I would say, on behalf of the whole nation, if you're really keen, go and do something else for 10 years. Anything. Run a business. Become a nurse. Travel abroad. I don't mean as a tourist. I mean doing something responsible. Work for a charity. Anything. So that when you go to a selection committee, you've actually got a bit of experience. I helped run the city of Birmingham for 8 years before I was interviewed to be an MP. And it was invaluable, absolutely invaluable. And that way, when you get there, you'll actually have something to talk about and some experience. You might actually have something you can fall back on if politics turns out to be as fickle a career as politics usually is. And you'll also have something else to do and to think about when you are not trying to deal with queries from constituents or the media or whatever. In other words, you'll have a balance. And that way, I would say, good luck.
That is brilliant advice. And if you do want to get into politics, that's advice that you should take. Also, have you got any more projects coming up? Maybe television, writing?
Well, the next project that comes up later this year is my 75th birthday. And I can
tell you.
Happy birthday in advance.
It's in October. There is no manual for being older. I started doing a tour that I do on cruise ships and for the U3A, not at the moment, obviously, called Growing Old Disgracefully. And I enjoy doing the talk. It reminds everybody that we have millions and millions of older people in this country. Boy, hasn't COVID reminded everyone of that.
Yes. Yeah.
And that we're not prepared to give up the ghost just yet, and that we're useful people. You've got millions of people in pensioner groups who are working, still working. They're volunteering back in the health service now and vaccination centres, and their expertise is being put to good use. We've got millions of people doing childcare. We've got millions of people doing grandchild care, as I do from time to time. And that also means that we can enjoy ourselves. We are the first generation to know that we're going to hit 90. So you better look after us, but not just yet. So that's what I'm up to, is doing my best to grow old disgracefully. And ask me again in 20 years' time.
Well, I will do. Hopefully I get to speak to you before 20 years' time. So I think that is actually the end of our podcast today, and we've covered a lot of things. It's been really good. Thank you for joining us today, Edwina. You've been an amazing guest. I hope everyone enjoyed that, and make sure to follow and listen to us on Spotify and iTunes, and subscribe to us on YouTube, and join us next week as we have another special guest with Dame Esther Ranson. So please stay safe, stay at home, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you very much, Edwina, for your time.
Thank you.
In business, you rarely hear the expression for life. You make a purchase for a product, for a service, and there's a time frame there. Well, that's not the case with Awaken 180 weight loss. Allow me to explain. You know, a year ago, I started with Awaken 180 weight loss and had incredible success losing weight. But you can lose all the weight in the world and not keep it off. And what good is it? That's why I have support for life from Awaken 180. Yeah. I mean, I go back for check-ins and make sure everything's going smoothly. But if I ever had a problem, the counselors are there to get me back on track. Why don't you do what I did and call for a consultation? 844-346-1800. 844-346-1800. Or go to awaken180weightloss.com.